This is a podcast from the South China Morning Post. I want you to do a thought experiment with me. I want you to imagine that right now, someone is about to walk up to you, wherever you are, and offer to inject you with a vaccine for COVID-19. Will you say yes? You've probably got some questions. Yes, it will be done safely by trained and qualified medical professionals. Whose vaccine is this, you might ask? Has it been tested? What if I tell you this vaccine has been tested on tens of thousands of people and has gone through phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials, and has been signed off by the COVAX program, backed by the Global Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, as well as the World Health Organization. Sounds reasonable? Assuming you're not part of the anti-vax, 5G, Bill Gates, UN World Government conspiracy crowd, getting vaccinated is probably something you've done before. Now, what if I tell you this vaccine was made in China? What if I tell you this vaccine was made by the Wuhan Institute of Biological Products? These are questions the Western world just might have to deal with in a couple of months. Because of the 8 vaccines currently in the final phase 3 clinical trials, 4 of them are made by Chinese companies. And yes, the Wuhan Institute of Biological Products is one of those frontrunners. We are about to enter a new phase of this pandemic. One where we will have to confront something called vaccine anxiety. Welcome to Inside China. My name is Qinling Lo, and this week we're headed back to the vaccine lab. Much of the Western media coverage of vaccines has been about the 2 vaccine frontrunners based in the US and the UK. You have most probably heard about the AstraZeneca trials being run via the University of Oxford and the Johnson & Johnson trials in the US. Maybe you didn't know that hundreds of thousands of people in mainland China have already received experimental COVID-19 vaccines after the Beijing central government granted emergency use licensing. This week, I'm bringing back 2 of my colleagues you last heard from our August 7th edition of Inside China. Back then, Simone McCarthy spoke to us about the concept of vaccine diplomacy and her stories analyzing the growing concerns about vaccine nationalism and fears that nations with the most money and resources would keep any proven COVID vaccine for themselves. There has been a major announcement by China about this, and she's going to take us through what this means, not just for China, but for the rest of the world. And you'll hear from Josephine Ma, one of the news editors on the China desk for the South China Morning Post. She first started reporting on the concept of coronavirus during the SARS outbreak in 2003. And since January this year, she has been leading the team tracking the research and development of vaccines and of the countries lining up to receive the Chinese-made COVID-19 vaccines. So Josephine, back in June, you told us the idea to develop a vaccine within such a short period of time, say 12 months or less, would be a momentous challenge for humanity. How are we doing?
We are doing pretty well. For the time being, 44 vaccines are already having clinical trials, and among them, 10 have already entered the last stage of trials to test the efficacy of the vaccine. So it has already broken the record of human history.
Can you give us a recap? Who are these Chinese companies that are currently involved in, as you said, the last phase of trials?
Sure. So far, we have 4 vaccines from 3 Chinese companies undergoing the last stage of clinical trials. 3 are called inactivated vaccines. They are like a more old-fashioned technology. And then 1 is a vectored vaccine.
So what are you hearing about how close they are to release these vaccines to the market?
Whether they can get a full license to roll out in the market really depends on the results of the last stage of the clinical trials. And all these 4 vaccines, they are still having the trials are still going on. We don't know the efficacy data yet. These companies are saying that they expect the interim result of clinical trial 3. So they will have the interim data by year end, and then the regulators will assess the data, and then they will decide whether the vaccine's effective and whether the vaccines can meet the requirement to be commercialized. Apart from the efficacy data, the regulators also will have to check the facilities and also the production capabilities of these producers to see whether they can produce vaccines with a steady, consistent quality. And that's very important to be able to get the license.
Although the vaccines are developed in China, I understand that they are under phase 3 trials elsewhere. So can you brief us where they are being tested right now?
Sure. The transmission in China is too low for clinical trial stage 3. And that's why all of these trials are being carried out in other countries. And the three Chinese vaccine developers, they are having trials like in a lot of different countries. For example, for Sinopharm, is having trials in several Middle East countries, also in South America, like Peru. And for Sinovac, is testing its vaccines, for example, in Brazil and also in Indonesia. And people are watching very carefully at these trials in Brazil and Indonesia because the governments are talking about importing these vaccines. And there are a lot of discussions going on. And for example, for Indonesia, it actually sent officials to China just about 2 weeks ago to check the data and also the production facilities of all these three Chinese vaccine producers, because they're considering whether to include these three Chinese vaccines into their emergency use program.
We know that inside mainland China, we've also published several reports on scmp.com of people who are actually being administered vaccines already. What's happening there?
Yes, it is really interesting because China has given emergency use permission of three inactivated vaccines since a couple of months ago. And quite a lot of people have already been given the vaccines under this so-called EUL, that's emergency use licensing.
Wait, so what is emergency use licensing?
It is a mechanism for experimental vaccines to be used on people facing high risk before full licensing. But of course, the regulators have to decide like the vaccines candidates are safe, given the data from trial 1 and 2 and also other information. In the past, I mean, they gave vaccines, for example, Ebola vaccines to frontline medical workers before full licensing. So this kind of mechanism has been used before. And the regulators, after they assess the data from clinical trial and 1 and 2 and also other information, they conclude that the benefits for the high-risk group is higher than the risk, then they may grant this emergency use licensing to experimental vaccines. What we are seeing now is very interesting because we see very different standard and interpretations about what is EUL. For example, for China, EUL was granted after phase 1 and 2 clinical trials. And the authorities, after they gave the permission, and then the vaccine producers start giving out vaccines to frontline medical workers and also people working at the border control. So they have been giving out vaccines. And then the scope of EUL in China has been expanding. A lot of people were quite shocked when the officials revealed that actually hundreds of thousands of people in China were already given these experimental vaccines. I'm referring to the three inactivated vaccines, the 1 by Sinovac and 2 by Sinopharm. And these people include people working in the supermarkets, people working in shops, people working in schools, people who have to deal with, like, for example, a lot of customers, and of course, people in elderly homes. And the officials argue, and also people who plan to travel abroad, like students who plan to travel abroad for their study, and business people or officials and workers. For example, China has a lot of projects in Belt and Road countries. So workers who plan to go to these countries to work, a lot of them have the vaccines. And from what we got, I mean, from our reporters, colleagues in China, they talked to some of these people. Some of these people who received vaccines were paid by their employers, and some actually paid from their own pocket. For Sinopharm vaccines, they have to pay for almost like 1,000 yuan for two doses. And now China expanded it. And for example, like a province in the coastal area, Zhejiang, has just announced not long ago that people can register for vaccines, and they have to pay for 200 yuan per dose to have the Sinovac vaccines. And it's quite controversial, because usually when we talk about EUL, emergency use licensing for high-risk people, usually we are not talking about that large number of people. So China has a very broad definition of high-risk groups. If you compare this with what is happening in the US, that's very interesting. Because for US, the regulators and the people, they have been talking about EUL, the possibility of EUL. And a lot of people actually oppose the idea for the regulator to give EUL without the efficacy data from trial 3. Of course, it also has to do with the pressure for the regulator, for the FDA, not to bow to the pressure from Trump, because Trump indicated before that there may be a vaccine before the election. And people were giving pressure to FDA, saying that you shouldn't bow to political pressure, and you have to make sure you only give out EUL, the emergency use licensing, when you have sufficient data. So the FDA actually tightened the requirement. FDA has to provide safety data for 2 months after people have the last shot. That's why some of these front runners, like Pfizer, they said they can only provide these kind of data in November. And because of all these concerns and the debate about whether we should give out EUL prematurely or when we should give out EUL, it actually make the US FDA to take a very interesting move. They actually opened one of their hearing for public just a few days ago, and the public can kind of like watch the discussion and the presentations from these regulators on YouTube and also from the website of FDA. So you can see like there is a large contrast there. For US, because of the political pressure, and also of course because of the professional standard, they are very careful about when they can give out emergency use licensing. And they are talking about they can only do that with data from clinical trial 3. So for China, their argument is all these people are facing high risk because they have to handle a lot of people. They're traveling abroad. And the clinical trial 1 and 2 have already proved that the vaccines are safe anyway. And administering the vaccines to these people will build a kind of like what they call a wall of protection. So when winter comes, because of these like high-risk people, they are already vaccinated, they may provide like protection so that the chance for like large transmission of the disease will be reduced because of this mass inoculation. So that's the Chinese argument. But they are doing that before any data from clinical trial 3. And that sparked like controversy, and people have like different kind of comments, but that's the Chinese argument. And they are waiting for clinical trial 3, the interim data, in the coming 2 months. And for that, with those data, they may consider giving out what we call conditional approval. So that means the vaccine candidates can be administered to the general public.
How are these emergency use licensed vaccines actually being received by the Chinese public? Are people really excited or are they worried?
Oh, they are very enthusiastic about it. To our surprise, that's actually. People actually paid from their pockets to get the vaccines. For example, like in the earlier stage of the EUL, the people, they will use the connections to, if they have friends working in the vaccine producers, or the employers will have some sort of like arrangement with the vaccine producers, and these people will go to the vaccine producers and they will have the vaccines. And a lot of these people are actually those who are planning to travel abroad. A lot of them are students or workers who want to be vaccinated before they travel. And they have to pay about 1,000 yuan per 2 doses. When China announced that the Zhejiang province, people in Zhejiang province, they can have Sinovac vaccines for 200 per dose. In some of the cities, we actually see people lining up outside CDC to have the vaccines. A lot of these people, they plan to travel abroad as well. And they are very enthusiastic. And our colleagues in mainland China actually told me a very interesting anecdote. She was talking to a senior executive from one of the vaccine producers in a big conference. And she saw these businessmen and journalists coming like around this person, exchanging name cards. And they actually asked how they could have the doses. So the perception of a lot of Chinese people, they actually have a lot of confidence in these vaccines. And they are very enthusiastic to have them. And they perceive that as like protection for them before they travel abroad or for the winter. Of course, some other people who plan to travel abroad, but there are still a lot of people who actually stay in China and they still want to be vaccinated. Of course, quite a significant number among the hundreds of thousands or even maybe more now who have been vaccinated may be kind of like arranged by their employers. And because their work units kind of like arrange people to have all the workers vaccinated, and they may just have to join the program. So they may just have to do it. But I don't see very strong resistance from the Chinese people from having these experimental vaccines.
I know in the USA, President Trump basically said that their military will help distribute these vaccines. But when we talk about China, where you said hundreds of thousands of people are already being vaccinated, actually, how was that being organized? Who was responsible for distributing the vaccines?
So at the beginning, people just went to the offices of these producers to have the vaccines. And not long ago, Sinopharm had a webpage and said people who are interested to be vaccinated can register, and people can choose what groups they are in. So those are the high-risk groups I mentioned earlier, and also people who plan to travel abroad. But there's also a category called others. So if you are not in one of those groups, you can still register to have the vaccines. So that's one way. And for Zhejiang province, the local CDC, they are organizing that as well. So that could be a pilot case. I don't know whether CDC from other provinces will do the same before winter comes.
So we've talked so much about vaccines, but you've recently wrote a story about testing and how that might still be very important for us. Can you talk about this?
Actually, the way to combat COVID-19 rely on 3 very important pillars. One is vaccine. One is accurate and fast test, Another one is therapeutics. So all these are equally important, even though most of the media attention has been given to vaccines. But just having vaccine is not alone. Because, number one, even if we have one or more vaccine candidates passing the basic requirements for clinical trial 3, there is still time needed to have to produce enough vaccines to be rolled out in so many countries. And how do you distribute the vaccine? How do you manufacture that huge amount of vaccine for the world population? It's not possible for them to supply the huge demand in the world. That's why scientists, including WHO, has been talking about we have to be realistic and don't expect enough vaccines for the world until the end of 2021. But that is given the vaccines passed the clinical trial 3. And for the time being, even though we have a lot of discussions, a lot of talks about all these promising candidates, for the time being, we don't know yet. There is chance, there is probability that the vaccines are proved to be effective and safe. But it is also possible that the immune response, the so-called T-cell and antibodies generated by the vaccines cannot protect people from the disease. There are a lot of uncertainties there. And even if you have vaccines which are proved to be safe and they can protect people from the disease, we are talking about the efficacy level of minimum efficacy level of 50%. That means half of the people who are vaccinated may be protected from the disease, and half may not if they take the 50% efficacy requirement. So we don't know yet. There are so many uncertainties out there.
So there might not be enough attention on testing, which is one of the three pillars that you've talked about. How is the development on testing going?
Yeah, that's a very good question. For the time being, the most accurate tests is what we call the PCR test. And that's what a lot of countries are using. And you can see people taking swab from people and then they take the samples to the laboratories. And then they have to go through some sort of process to amplify the genetic material they collected and to find out whether a person is infected with COVID-19. And the process of that actually has been shortened a lot. These days, even in Hong Kong, you can see people can have the result very quickly, a day. Before it may take 2 days or a little bit more. And for the lab test, you can just have the result within an hour or two. But if you include time required from sample collection to getting the final result and have the result being relayed to a person, that may take 1 day or 2 days. So it's going on pretty well, but that's not fast enough. Some scientists actually have raised the idea that in order to resume social activities before we have a super safe and effective vaccine that lasts for a long time, then we really need fast and accurate tests. And the most ideal case is, of course, people can test that at home, right? You can collect your own samples and there's a simple kit for you to find out whether you are infected with COVID-19 or not, and then you can decide whether you go to work or whether you go to visit your grandpa. So that's the most ideal scenario, but that's not happening yet. Because the antigen tests, these are the quick tests that we have right now, they are not accurate enough. Some people who don't like the idea are talking about if you're false negative, that means you are having the disease, but the test don't show it, then it may give you a false sense of security. You may like go around to restaurants without wearing your mask, and you may be spreading the disease. So that's the argument against it. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't work on having a fast and accurate test. Right now, the regulators, they kind of like set the standard at like, if you can find out 80% of the positive cases, you may pass the standard for example, the US FDA to be given approval for the test kits to be used. Some of these test kits actually can meet that standard, but they require a small machine to read the result because you still have to amplify the sample with some sort of technology. And so they are not the kind of like strip tests we talk about yet, but they are like moving toward that direction. And having these kind of relatively accurate tests, you can actually read the result within 15 minutes. It's pretty quite fast. And you can do that, for example, in schools, in clinics. So that's a way to go. That's what scientists are working on and what regulators are looking at as well. So I think we are moving towards like a right direction, even though we are not there yet.
Well, obviously, people can follow more of the development of vaccine and testing from your stories and your columns, Joe, on scmp.com. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So, Simone, back in August, you were talking about some of the fears being expressed by experts and academics about vaccine nationalism, of countries keeping vaccines for themselves. It's now late October, almost into November. How has that been played out in the vaccine development?
Yeah, I think it's really a question that remains hanging. A lot of the experts that I've been speaking to do remain concerned about it. Actually, just yesterday, the Rand Corporation think tank put out a report saying that unequal allocation of vaccines could cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.2 trillion a year off GDP. So this is really a very real concern, as predictions are $16 billion as far as what production might be for vaccines next year. I mean, that's assuming everything goes through, everything goes well, there's no delays. But of that, some $8 billion have already been spoken for, and about $2.5 billion of those are earmarked for lower and middle income countries. But depending on who gets through, some of the major front runners in the race are actually largely bought up by the European Union, United States, and UK. So it's really kind of it's down to what actually happens, what vaccines go through when, and a lot's being done to try and work towards equitable access. But a lot of those problems still really remain, and we might see, a pretty messy situation as the rollout comes through.
I remember talking to you about the global COVAX agreement, which basically wants to address the problem you just mentioned. And we know that earlier this month, China signed on to join COVAX, overturning or like changing a previous position. Can you tell us what this means to the world?
Yeah, so COVAX is really, you know, as I just mentioned, there's been a lot of work going towards having timely and equitable distribution of vaccines. And COVAX is really at the fore of that, led by WHO, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and CEPI, Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. So basically, since we last talked, there's been 184 countries that have decided to become part of the program. And about half of those are lower and middle income countries that will be able to receive doses that are largely funded through donations. They will have to pay a small amount, most likely, maybe $1.60 to $2 US per dose. But otherwise, they should be able to be funded through that mechanism, whereas the rest of the countries have agreed to self-finance. And so they'll use COVAX as sort of a brokering mechanism to get access. And so that will allow the mechanism to equitably distribute vaccines to up to 20% of each of those countries' populations. China joining was a huge boost for COVAX in terms of getting that international backing. China is the world's second largest economy, as we know. And so this really meant a lot that that Beijing was behind this. And they waited until October 9th, which was literally the deadline to send in your check. And so it was really sort of a, well, I guess the announcement was on that day and they had decided the day before. And so it was really like an 11th hour kind of decision there. But it certainly boosts what COVAX wants to do. And the heads of Gavi were very, very happy to be able to say that China had joined on. But I would say, on the other hand, there is a question about what it actually means. Part of it may be somewhat symbolic, and not to say that's not important, but China has said that they've only asked to take enough vaccines for 1% of their population through the mechanism. So that's about 15 million people. And so the way the COVAX works is that the self-financing companies have to pay a set amount for those vaccines. And there's two different options. And as far as I know, there hasn't been any public information released about which one China has agreed to or any specifics of the deal. But based on what Gavi has said, I ran the numbers and it looks like China might have submitted either, you know, somewhere between 100 to a little over 300 million to secure that many doses.
Wait, Simone, so what you've been saying just now is about China wanting to get vaccines from the COVAX agreement. But isn't China one of the forerunners in making vaccines? Are they going to supply vaccines to all the countries who signed COVAX?
Yeah, that's a really good question and an important distinction in this conversation, I think. So basically, China has certainly made it clear that they would like Chinese-made vaccines to be included in those that are distributed through the COVAX facility. But China joining COVAX does not mean that their vaccines will automatically be included. That's a separate process, and that would also, as I understand, that would also require those vaccines to be vetted by the World Health Organization and go through their pre-qualification program as well. So certainly China's diplomats have said that they're very interested in having those vaccines go through there and that conversations are ongoing. But we don't yet know whether or not those vaccines will be included. And it is kind of an interesting question, too, because as we discussed last time, China has made a number of promises and pledges to various countries that they'll get priority access for the vaccine. And then we also have, of course, China itself having a very large population. China's production capability for vaccines is about 1 billion total for 2021 projected. So it certainly remains to be seen how exactly Beijing would want to allocate, you know, the companies working in coordination with Beijing, how exactly they would want to allocate that, whether it's going towards COVAX as what Xi Jinping calls a global public good, or whether they're also, you know, sending those vaccines that are actually manufactured in China to other countries.
So the discussion of vaccine nationalism cannot be talked about without addressing vaccine diplomacy. Is China joining COVAX more evidence of them trying to play up vaccine diplomacy?
That's a good question. I mean, certainly China making bilateral deals with countries to supply certain doses can, at least, you know, experts have said that can reinforce some of China's specific diplomatic aims, whether in the South China Sea, with the Philippines, or various examples. But China has also looked to show itself as a good team player on the international stage. You know, Kinley, you do a lot of reporting about those issues. And this is just one more example of that, as far as really showing that they're part of the international structure. They want to be a good team player. And then we have, you know, the United States on the other side, who really hasn't, who certainly has not joined COVAX, who hasn't made those kinds of agreements, who has been pursuing an America First policy under the Trump administration. So it certainly creates a contrast. I guess the one other thing that I might add, though, is that this, from a sort of a business perspective, China has also been interested in expanding its exports of vaccines to the global market for some time. And there's a handful of Chinese vaccines which have gotten WHO pre-qualification, which means that they can be procured by UNICEF and other agencies to be distributed as part of their program. So if these vaccines are included in COVAX, then that could be a significant boost to how Chinese vaccines are viewed globally.
So what are you working on right now, Simone?
Well, I just wrapped up an article where I was speaking with a few experts about some of the supply chain problems that we might see during this vaccine rollout. The glass vials were a hot issue back in the spring, although it seems like, at least COVAX has secured their supply of glass vials along with some others. But there are going to be a lot of issues as everybody's grappling for these supplies at the same time. And some of that might be specialized chemicals that some of the vaccines need, or even stuff as straightforward as alcohol pads and syringes. If everybody's kind of going all out at once, how resilient are these supply chains? And so that's something that I'm just starting to burrow into a little bit more with some reporting on how we might see some of those issues play out.
Thank you for speaking to us, Simone, and looking forward to reading more of your stories.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here.
That's all we have for you this week from Inside China. As always, keep up to date with the latest news on our 24-hour coverage on scmp.com. My name is Kinling Lo. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.